Welcome back to the Dealmakers Podcast Show with serial entrepreneur Alejandro Cremades, best-selling author of The Art of Startup Fundraising and co-founder at Panthera Advisors. In this podcast, we ask our guests about their successful acquisitions and financing rounds.
Alrighty, hello everyone and welcome to the Dealmakers Show. So today we have a really exciting founder and a founder that has done it, a couple of times. And the last one is a rocket ship, the one that he's saying really riding now. And we're going to be talking about this. We're going to be talking about all the good stuff, how to get your first customer, how to say no to big money coming from customers, how to think about your go-to-market strategy, or even how to go about hiring and how to think about employees that can have a tremendous impact within your organization. So again, brace yourself for a very inspiring conversation because the building, scaling, financing, and all of that jazz is coming to a theater near you. So without further ado, let's welcome our guest today, Rohit Chudhari. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Alejandro. Thank you so much. Really excited to be here.
So originally born in India. So give us a walk through memory lane. How was life growing up for you?
Well, life was good. I grew up in a family of three kids. I have an older brother and, my older sister. So always, the extremely pampered one in the house. I grew up where my father was an employee of the National Bank, Bank of India. It was very, very interesting. My mother was a homemaker and she took care of us while my father was, away trying to make ends meet. I grew up in a middle-class family in India and, education was primary. If you did not study hard, you would get, let me say a scolding, beating, whatever. But education was primary. Education for my family has been the most important thing. And my parents emphasized on that, big time. And I think, it's gone the same way for my sister and my brother as well.
So how do you get into engineering, out of all things, Rohit?
A very interesting story. I think I started reading about, computers in 1994. I started with, GW Basic, and I just instantly took a liking to computer programming and, thinking about building calculators and, restaurant management systems eventually as my 10th grade project. And I just got, so interested in computers. I liked the fact that the keyboard would make a clicking noise. The mechanical keyboards were my favorite, and I used to really love the different routines that you could write in GW Basic. And then eventually I transitioned to C and then to C++ in my 12th grade. And I, ever since I've just been in love with, everything which is related to programming.
And obviously, you've been a software engineer for quite some time, for about 15 years or so. But one of the startups that was saying that really played a pivotal role for you was Imovie, no? So with Imovie, ultimately, that was the segue, into you getting going into not only the startup world, but, basically your segue into becoming an entrepreneur. So how was that that experience like, and what was that transition into also the world of entrepreneurship?
Yeah, I mean, the first 3-4 years I spent at, working on different projects. I was at a company called Tavant, and I used to work for Electronic Arts. I got an opportunity to work on extremely complex and interesting projects like Sims and Sims 3, Sims Carnival. These were like the days when gaming was getting sort of, online. And we were, very fortunate to have seen that transition of massive companies like EA to, completely online gaming. It was very interesting. I was responsible for building search and infrastructure. And then 2007, something changed in the world, and it was called the iPhone. October 2007, iPhone came around. And the founders of Imovie, they spotted the opportunity that, there are going to be at least 10, 15 times more mobile devices than there are going to be desktop and computers. And the advertising scene on the small screen is set for a revolution. And they felt that, there's a huge opportunity to go and build a mobile advertising network. And I met, the founders in 2008, early 2008. And, it was a hugely inspirational moment for me to figure out that people, who were sitting in India in extremely good jobs, they were quitting their extremely high-paying consulting and technology jobs, and they were going after building for a new market. And I just could not resist the temptation of being part of that. So I became one of the earliest engineers of, Imovie. And depending upon how you count, it's either number 3 or number 6. But you could say that we were there at almost day zero. The Series A check had just been written, and we felt that there was a huge opportunity to build a massive platform, something that I had not attempted, in the past. And I think it became an important lesson for me in life that if you can think something up, then you can also find the right people and you can go ahead and build that solution that you think should be brought to life. a hugely important, you know, moment for me.
So then talk to us about that moment where the idea of, you know, getting going with your own company, you know, which would be Abstergix, you know, like how did that come knocking to you? And at what point do you feel it's time, you know, for me to take a crack at entrepreneurship?
Yeah, I think this is the question that everybody struggles with. You know, I was in one of the meetings with one of the VCs when I was at Abstergix, and, you know, a very favorite person of mine, he actually said something very interesting, which I still remember to this day. He said, being an entrepreneur is almost like a non-decision, that you must be an entrepreneur. But how did it come to me? You know, I'd spent about 4 years at InMobi, and I'd seen the massive ups and, you know, some downs, but mostly the ups that came along with the business. It was just unbelievable. It was a true rocket ship. We went from like zero to hundreds of millions of dollars in overall ad spend and, you know, so much more in revenue on that platform in such a short period of time. We went through many, many platformization changes. We rewrote the entire platform to cater to the scale of the business at least twice or thrice in those 4 years that I spent over there. And I felt that I had developed the maturity both on the technical side and on the business side to go and give it a crack. It also becomes important that, you know, you feel, I felt that I had an opinion and a voice for the next market that I was going to target. I felt that, you know, I was ready as a technical founder to go and start my own company. Now, obviously, all of that was not true. You know, as I found out later in Abstergix, that, you know, the preparation needs a lot more practice. And, you know, of course, there's nothing better than match practice or game time. The more time that you spend, you know, as an entrepreneur, the better you get at it. The way that the idea of Abstergix came to us was that we figured out while I was working at InMobi that this is going to be a multi-platform world in case of, you know, iOS and Android. And at that point in time, it seemed that, you know, the world will fragment further. But now it has obviously turned the opposite way, which is that the consolidation between the iOS and the Android is permanent. But at that point in time, it appeared that, you know, there's going to be so many more applications coming into the world. The app economy was taking off. And we felt that virtualization for the mobile space, doing things like, you know, mobile device management, securing the devices, et cetera, would be a big space. So we started off with the idea of, you know, virtualizing the mobile OS itself, which itself was like a huge technical undertaking for which we were not really ready at that point in time, but we still gave it a solid crack. And as it happens inside startups, you know, over a period of time, you continue to pivot over many, many different kinds of ideas. And the good thing that we did at Abstergix was that we continued to pivot like every 2 months. And what we found out was that, you know, mobile meetings will be a big theme going forward in the world. And what we ended up building was the precursor to something like a Zoom, which allowed you to, you know, transfer voice and share content on mobile devices. We synchronized across, you know, Android and iOS devices and used the latest and greatest, you know, WebSocket and other technologies that had just come on the scene. Now, eventually that got subsumed at 247AI, and we provided, you know, this co-browsing experience for customer support use cases for, you know, people who are trying to look for great deals and make purchases, book online vacations. So it became like a very good natural fit. But the inspiration was that, you know, mobile devices were going to be a big theme in the future. Just like, you know, it was almost like a continuation of the work that I had done at InMobi in terms of, you know, dealing with large scale infrastructure, et cetera.
So then in this case, you know, like what ended up happening with the Abstergix, because, you know, it ended up going through an acquisition. So walk us through what were the motions of that M&A process and how did that came about and how did you guys go about executing on that journey too?
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, two lessons that I tell all my, you know, entrepreneur colleagues and friends is that, you know, our founder friends and colleagues, that, you know, please keep making, you know, the network and the relationship so that tomorrow at least you have an option of, you know, doing something else with the time and money that you have so that you at least go through an acquisition. And, you know, networking was important for us. But let me walk you through, you know, the sequence of events, which I think, you know, many will find very interesting and important. And many of those hard knocks that I took during the time of Abstergix have now become so crucial and important in, you know, guiding and running Accelerator. I think the number one mistake that we made was that we did not focus on the ideal customer persona. We were not very focused on, you know, trying to figure out or trying to find who are the people that we are actually building this capability or these capabilities for. We were not very focused on that. I think we should have been a lot more focused on, you know, those capabilities and making sure that we were building for a persona. The second thing, obviously, was that we were very intent and focused on building the product and the technology as opposed to going and building a business. And I don't think we managed to make the transition from building a product to building a business. I think that was the second mistake. And in the absence of, you know, the ideal customer profile and who and why will you win in the market, it gets really hard for, you know, VCs to think about your company or product as a fundable business, which will return a certain set of dollars in a fixed period of time. And we were not therefore able to, you know, raise capital. I think the fourth thing, if I were to say, we were not successful in getting the right kind of people to join us. Because I'm sure that, you know, if a lot more talented people had joined us, the story could have been way bigger than the outcome that we got. In terms of, you know, how we went about the process, we figured out, you know, about 19 months, no funding, running after customers one after the other, not being able to close deals. We figured out that we were probably not in the best position to continue with that journey. And so the idea there then became was that what is the best home for this piece of technology? And the two of us who were, you know, co-founders. You know, my co-founder and I, we actually took a very quick decision when the offer came to us that, you know, there's a possibility that this is a tech and talent acquisition, you know, and this will be a great home for the technology and for the mission to continue. And the mission did continue. We deployed at really large companies after that, AT&T, Best Buy, Hilton. The technology actually took off.
So then after the transaction happened, you know, you were at it for about, I mean, obviously you did the integration, you know, with the company that acquired the company, you know, which was a 24/7, I believe. But in after that, you went to Hortonworks. I mean, it took like about, give or take, about 5 years, you know, for you to kind of like feel that, I don't know if it was the confidence back or the right timing, you know, for you to go at it again. Because as they say, once an entrepreneur, always an entrepreneur. So what were the motions there, you know, the sequence of events that needed to be realized for you to feel that it was the time to go at it again with Accel Data?
Yeah, I mean, it's the most interesting journey. So, you know, it is all, when you look at it in retrospect, you find that it's a few dots which join, but you don't see the dots joining forward. You only can, you know, figure it out as you're looking at backwards. So the first time that, you know, I started interacting with large data platforms was at InMobi, you know, because we were dealing with a lot of advertising and publishing data. We were doing ad matching algorithms, collecting logs from all over the system. And the first time that we started installing Hadoop in InMobi was, you know, way back in 2008, 2009 timeframe. So the exposure for, you know, from a big data perspective, from large volumes of data, you know, for real-time batch and reporting perspective was always there. 247 AI was no different. We were collecting a lot of signals, you know, we were trying to, you know, synthesize those signals and give the right inputs to the operational folks, etc. So I think, you know, that journey of data had continued. Hortonworks came together very differently. So Hortonworks was very interesting because it was also a moment for the industry which figured out that everybody is going to collect a lot more data in the future, you know, compared to what they had at that point in time. The second thing that we figured out that, or not we, but I think companies like Yahoo and Google had set precedent that open source software was going to be pretty significant in the next 10, 20 years of computing. That was the second insight. And I felt that, you know, communities which are being built, you know, around large scale storage, large scale compute on commodity based hardware and not expensive hardware are going to be critical. So I think the selection became very easy. So it was very easy choice that, you know, I want to go and get involved in the community, which is going to work in the future for both data and AI. And it was very clear that data and machine learning were already, you know, top of mind problems by, you know, for people in 2014 timeframe. The kind of work that I did at Hortonworks was involving three different personas: people who took care of the infrastructure, people who were interacting with data through algorithms, which are data scientists, and people who were actually dealing with large-scale data processing using batch and real-time processing engines like Hive, like Spark, which have now become the bedrock of, you know, modern SQL technology and modern data science technology. I was also, you know, so I was working on all of those projects together and products together. In you know, as an outside in view, I was also working with a lot of customer requests and a lot of, you know, banks, financial institutions, telecom companies, and many others. And I figured out that, you know, operating these massive data systems is going to be a problem. But, you know, obviously life happens in between. I could see that there's an opportunity to do something way bigger and build a large company, which we are trying to do at Accel Data. But life also happens in between. You know, my mom was not well. I had two, you know, young boys between timeframe 2012 and 2015. There were like a lot of things happening at home as well. So I wanted to make sure that, you know, two things, the mistakes that I made in the previous one, that I want to be clear about the ideal customer profile and persona that we'll go after. I also wanted to make sure that we had the right team with whom I could work for the next 10 years together. And I was very, very sure that, you know, we have to nail the market opportunity and the right partners from an investment perspective. Once we had all of that figured out, obviously it became a lot easier to make the decision, take the leap and then start again.
Hey guys, so pardon the interruption here. So I got to tell you that, you know, for those of you that are either looking to raise money or you're looking to get your company acquired, you don't have to be alone. You know, there's a lot of psychology that needs to be blended with strategy, with methodology, with process. And it's very hard. And already doing your business alone is super, super difficult. So I remember, you know, back then when I was an entrepreneur, I kept really experiencing the challenge of either knowing or finding the right type of access to the right type of investors, or really understanding what was the right type of guidance, you know, that would carry me through the process, whether it was with seeking money or with going through the acquisition. So that gap that I found being an entrepreneur is ultimately what pushed me later on when I met my co-founder at Pantera, Mike Severson, to really put together an advisory firm where we are guiding entrepreneurs and founding teams through the capital raising efforts, whether you are at a seed stage or at a Series A stage, or if you are going through the process of an acquisition and you are in small to mid-cap type of cycle. So again, you know, we would help you from guiding you and supporting you from A to C all the way to the end as an extension of your team. And there's no reason for you to do this alone. So with that being said, if you would like to find out more, feel free to send me an email at alejandro@panteraadvisors.com, and we would love to take a look at helping you out.
So then talk to us about that moment where you are like, let's go, you know, let's do this.
Yeah, I mean, the moment is actually a year before we started. I figured out that, you know, this is going to be a huge opportunity. As I was thinking, you know, everybody thinks in terms of models, right? I mean, the whole training of the human brain happens in terms of, okay, where have I seen this and can this be repeated? And, you know, another great company that came out of India, you know, many years ago was AppDynamics. You know, Jyoti Bansal, amazing founder. But we followed his story about, you know, what he was able to do with AppDynamics. AppDynamics was built after 15 years of successful IT application deployment, which became mission critical. And we figured out that, you know, these mission critical pieces of software need monitoring. And my assumption or my presupposition for the whole problem statement was that, you know, data applications, data products will become literally the lifeblood of the modern organization as they're dealing with so many more data, so many more signals, and the amount of outcomes that they can actually produce by focusing their entire attention on data is just immense and massive. Therefore, they will become mission critical. And we felt that probably there's like a next generation of Datadog or AppDynamics to be built here for data ecosystems. And that was the unique insight, you know, and the way that it came together was that, you know, operators are having trouble operating these massive platforms. Data scientists were not getting the right level and the right quality of data. And the people who were supposed to produce analytics, they were not able to produce that at the right time or at the right time or at the right cost. And trust me, companies were already pouring in so much money into their BI analytics and machine learning efforts that it just made sense for us to go and start this company in 2018.
So what ended up being the business model of Axel Data? How do you guys make money?
Yeah, so a couple of things, right? So 2018, when we started, you know, of course, you have to think about a company in terms of 10 years of horizon. So it took about, you know, 6 months to build the first version of the product. We came out into the market and we actually started providing visibility into operations for big data clusters that, you know, if you have thousands of nodes deployed on your on-premise or on your cloud infrastructure, this is how you actually, you know, gain superior performance, manage it automatically, and you're not people dependent. So you're not running after, you know, GSIs and RSIs at that point in time to provide the key and the value, you know, the valuable support in order for you to run your day-to-day operations. Your queries finish on time, your reports are provided to your business users on time, and you're doing it at reasonable costs. So we started that journey first. And obviously, you know, the pricing that we have, you know, throughout all our products, you know, and at this point in time, we have 4 different products. All of these products are consumption based, you know, the number of nodes that you deploy, the number of cores that you deploy on, the amount of data that you scan, the number of queries that you monitor. So we actually put very simple vectors in front of our customers. And depending upon what they choose from the menu, the pricing is on the right side, you know, you multiply the whole thing, pay a flat platform fee, and you're up and running. this is very important as well, particularly in times like these where IT budget spending is so, you know, is being examined through extreme levels of detail. It is really important that, you know, large transaction companies, whether it's credit card companies or telcos or whoever it is, you cannot have the cost of data processing become greater than the value that it returns to the organization. The cost of data processing, the quality of data, that all of that has to yield a 10x value. Otherwise, it becomes really difficult to justify, you know, future investments. And when you put something like data observability, it allows you to manage your data in a way that it becomes the most effective at the most reasonable prices and costs. I think, you know, that has become the value proposition for the company in the last, you know, 5-6 years.
So then also tell us about how do you guys go about, for example, like getting that first customer? You know, what was that journey like?
Oh, that was sort of a euphoric moment. So our first customer, you know, who was one of the largest, you know, conglomerates, a very popular company in the US. I don't think I'm at liberty to name them, but you know, it was a huge customer. And the first contract that we got was $220,000. And this was built on the back of the effort of, you know, just four people sitting in a WeWork office and just endlessly coding, speccing for about, you know, 5 months time. But it was a huge euphoric moment because what we figured out was that if we could build something as valuable for such a huge company, a Fortune 10, a Fortune 20 company, we figured out that, you know, we've landed upon something that if we keep at that for many, many years, we will have a large company at our hands. So it was an amazing moment.
As you're talking, you know, here about maybe like applying it to others, you know, talk to us about go-to-market strategy.
I think, you know, many times this has been said before, so this is not an original. I think an extreme amount of focus on your eventual user to delight them and an extreme value engineering or value focus on your buyer will actually get the job done. So if you're extremely focused on the key problem that your sponsor is going to, you know, worry about and pay for, that's a great way to, you know, secure your dollars. And if you can provide the best experience to the people who are going to implement, use your tools and technologies, if you can delight them, then you've actually just satisfied both of those contingencies. And sometimes it's, you know, it's counterintuitive to focus on something which doesn't exist, because if you're doing category creation such as us, you know, when we started in 2018, there was no concept of data observability. People did not know that you could actually implement these tools and make life better. It is important to stick to unknown markets for a little longer than it would normally seem to suggest, because the gestation period for new markets to come together is anywhere between 6 and 7 years. So depending upon, you know, what your strategy is, if you're entering a new market, if you're trying to create a new market, you'll also have to do a lot of work on GTM. And namely, you know, to your question that, you know, what are things that you should be focused on? Obviously, the ICP focus and you know, delighting your user, those are two tenets of the product. But you also have to organize and create the market, which is you do have to speak to the problem. And obviously, you have to be part of a cohort of companies that get created before and after you. And the messaging has to be sort of, you know, differentiated, but also has to support the theme of what you're trying to create in the market. I think if you are an enterprise first company, which, you know, we are basically the only ones which have a massive coverage in terms of all the five pillars of what Gartner has defined eventually as data observability. It's important to also educate your different constituents, you know, which is analysts, buyers, users. And, you know, you need to keep doing that for many, many years before your, you know, product becomes mainstream. So I think, you know, if you're an early market category creation, you know, start investing in the messaging as well as soon as you can. Final thing I would say, you know, don't be shy of selling. You know, as a founder, I thoroughly enjoy selling. It's really important that you get empathetic with the problems that your sponsors, your exec sponsors, your buyers are concerned about and would like solutions for. And we take that responsibility very seriously that, you know, yes, we've taken money and we're going to solve these problems for you. I would say those are like 4 or 5 different things that, you know, GTM.
And what about capital raising? You know, you guys have raised over 100 million. How has it been the journey of raising money too? Because that's a lot of zeros.
Yeah, that's a lot of zeros. Again, lots of responsibilities. I don't think we've raised unreasonable sums of capital. We've raised so much that we feel extremely comfortable, you know, with. You know, you don't need to raise excessive capital because it's not a vanity metric. Eventually, you have to pay for it. Eventually, you have to actually return business value out of it. So one needs to be very careful. I can give like a framework. One, obviously, you have to have long-term capital providers who are not actually limited by the number of years that the company has been in the journey with. And they have to truly be strategic. They should have the capability of, you know, opening doors, providing you access to talent, operating models and margins and everything else. That's like the first thing. Second thing is, are they in your space or not? And we were very careful to select, you know, companies or, you know, capital providers, capital partners who had both the operating experience, but they also had the deep domain experience when it came to data, because it is very hard to explain certain things to people who, for example, are doing e-commerce or SaaS software. It's very hard for infrastructure companies to actually have, you know, the same partnership or the same partner presence in a different kind of a company. So we had to be very domain specific because we're also, you know, creating a new category. And the third thing, obviously, is that, you know, you have to make sure that your valuation is reasonable so that everybody makes money. So if you can keep the company's interest and, you know, the investor's interest in mind in the long term, I think, you know, you will have the right raise. We raised in different series of rounds. We obviously got the initial series, you know, seed, where we already had a very long-term relation with Lightspeed. We raised our A with Sorensen Leading, B with Insight, and C with March, and we've raised 4 rounds of funding so far. Obviously, there are like many, many associated partners who actually put in small checks in each of these rounds. But so far, you know, it has been a very, very fantastic and a very rewarding journey for, you know, for us and the investors as well.
So obviously with investors, you know, there is a bet on vision, right? And then, you know, vision is not only important for investors, but then also for customers and also for employees, right? So if you were to go to sleep tonight, Rohit, then you wake up in a world where the vision of Axel Data is fully realized. What does that world look like?
That world looks like, you know, that world is called the zero-touch data management paradigm, where, you know, customers are not being forced to act on so many things on their own. But become, you know, the system has completely, data observability has inverted their life, and they're actually being, you know, largely guided and recommended to what they should be doing and where they should be focused there, you know, they should be focusing their energy on. Because the enterprise data landscape continues to grow at a pace that it almost becomes impossible for people to be able to contain that or manage that on a manual basis. What does it mean? It essentially means that you should be able to, you know, search and discover all your important data assets, where you should be taking action today across, you know, CRM, ERP, operational data store, relational data stores, and big data, you know, systems, whether it's on cloud or on-premise or hybrid scenarios. You should be able to, you know, get the action items for you as opposed to a list or a category or an inventory, number one. Number two, you should be able to initiate very easy workflows for business use cases or for business workflows or for data quality or reliability or security. You should be able to start and finish or accomplish those workflows very, very quickly. The third thing I would say is that, you know, when you get into a problem, getting preemptive alerts, which are not noisy, I would say, you know, that's like the third leg of the stool. Because if you get these three things to do, where your workflows are centralized, your discovery is, you know, inverted, and you're getting the most important data assets, et cetera, and you're able to act on alerts or things that may happen in the future, which could, you know, cause an outage or business loss, I think, you know, you have set data management straight, which I think has so far been an unsolved problem.
So now we're talking about the future, but I want to talk about the past and doing so with a lens of reflection. If I was to bring you back in time, mm-hmm. And I bring you back in time, maybe, you know, to that moment that you were thinking about perhaps starting something of your own, okay? And let's say, you know, now I bring you back to that moment, let's say 2012 or so, before you got going with Abstergo, and you're able to give that younger Rohit one piece of advice before launching a business. What would that be and why, given what you know now?
Yeah, well, Matt. You know, the one piece of advice I'll give is obviously that, you know, keep working hard, but keep working on a few focused things than many different things. I think, you know, developing some depth in certain areas is better than, you know, spreading yourself too thin. And I think I made that mistake at Abstergo. I was trying to code, test, deploy software solution, talk to customers and everything else. And it's good, you know, it's good to have that energy to go at the market. I think what I would also tell the younger Rohit is that, you know, don't lose your naivete that you will actually get it done. Because when you know too much, it becomes very difficult to take decisions because you also know the downsides. So, I'm glad that, you know, the story played out the way that it did. You know, I made so many mistakes and, you know, I'm better with that. So maybe another advice is that, you know, it'll all work out in the end.
I hear you. So, Rohit, for the people that are listening that would love to reach out and say hi, what is the best way for them to do so?
I'm on LinkedIn, RC Online. I'm also RC Online on Twitter. And I'm always happy to have like a thorough conversation on technology, product, customer, GTM, whatever you feel like, data management. You know, that's a passion area. Happy to talk about that at any point.
Amazing. Well, Rohit, thank you so much for being on the Dealmaker Show today. It has been an absolute honor to have you with us.
Thank you so much, Alejandro.
If you like the show, make sure that you hit that subscribe button. If you could leave a review as well, that would be fantastic. And if you got any value, either from this episode or from the show itself, share it with a friend. Perhaps they also appreciate it. So also remember that if you need any help, whether it is with your fundraising efforts or with selling your business, you can reach me at alejandro@pantheraadvisors.com.
You've reached the end of another episode of the Dealmakers Podcast. For free resources and materials, head over to alejandrocremades.com. Thank you for listening, and see you at the next episode.